From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, they hate commercialism, stardom, and all the trappings of success. They're the post-punk band Fugazi. The group has managed to become internationally known, even though they've refused to sign with a major label. We'll meet band members Ian Mackay and Guy Picciotto. Also, a new declaration of Iranian intellectuals and artists in defense of Salman Rushdie. We talk with two of the signers. And book critic John Leonard reviews Toni Morrison's new novel, Jazz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Members of Russian President Boris Yeltsin's cabinet stormed out of the Congress of People's Deputies today after the chairman of the Congress accused them of blackmail. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
After a week of battling between President Yeltsin and the Congress, nerves were frayed and tempers short. Earlier today, Yeltsin's cabinet threatened to resign unless the Congress rescinds a bill it passed Saturday, which Yeltsin's team considers a setback to its economic reform plan. Late this afternoon, it seemed that the Congress and the president were on the verge of compromise when the chairman of the Congress, Ruslan Hasbulatov, apparently lost his temper. He accused Yeltsin's team of blackmail. They walked out of the Congress, hundreds of deputies started shouting, and then Hasbulatov stormed out. Afterwards, Yeltsin's aides accused the Congress's leadership of making a clumsy grab for power. Relations between the Congress and Yeltsin have now reached a low point, and there is a consensus growing that only Yeltsin, by appealing directly to the Congress tomorrow, can avert a constitutional crisis. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Former President Ronald Reagan was attacked today by a man who struck him and smashed a crystal trophy that he'd been given. Reagan told CNN that the man struck him a glancing blow with a fist, but that he was unhurt. The 81-year-old former president was receiving a Distinguished Service Award from the National Association of Broadcasters in Las Vegas when the man rushed on stage. Witnesses said the man shouted, asking Reagan how he could speak while nuclear testing was going on. The man snatched a crystal statue that had been given to the former president and smashed it. He was caught and hustled away by security officers. Neil Kinnock, the leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party, has resigned his position 4 days after Labour's defeat by Prime Minister John Major's Conservatives in Britain's general election. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Kinnock's resignation had been widely expected following last week's defeat. He's led the party since 1983 and is credited with bringing it back from near oblivion after the 1983 general election, when a Labour dominated by the left managed just 28% of the popular vote. Labour's performance has improved since then, but after two elections under Kinnock's leadership, the party has been unable to end its 13 years in opposition. At a news conference called to announce his resignation, Kinnock blamed the conservative press for a campaign of disinformation against Labour that had helped decide the election. A successor is expected to be elected at a special party conference in June. Labour's economic spokesman John Smith is the favorite, but could face opposition from the party's left. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela announced today that he and his wife Minnie have agreed to separate. Mandela told reporters that the 33-year marriage had been strained by differences over the issues in the fight against apartheid. On Wall Street today, blue-chip stock prices were up. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 15 points to close at 3,269.9. This is NPR News from Washington. The Arab League has come up with a new proposal to resolve the impasse over Libya's refusal to give up the suspects in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. In a letter to the United Nations Security Council, the Arab League proposed that the suspects should be handed over to the Mediterranean island nation of Malta. At the same time, the proposal calls for the postponement of threatened UN sanctions against Libya. It didn't specify when the two suspects might be transferred by Malta to the United States and Britain, where they're wanted for trial. Hundreds of thousands of workers evacuated Chicago's downtown loop today after water flooded into an old system of underground tunnels and threatened the city's electrical system. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
At this hour, crews are at work trying to fill a hole in one of the retaining walls of the Chicago River. They're using sandbags, gravel, quick-setting cement, and dozens of lime-green mattresses. The hole is usually described as the size of a Buick. When it appeared this morning, it sent water rushing into old underground tunnels, over 250 million gallons of water, moving so fast that it was unsafe to send divers to inspect the damage. Water is now standing in office building basements throughout downtown Chicago, in some places as deep as 30 feet. Officials are planning on draining the water into an even deeper hole in the ground called the Deep Tunnel, 250 feet down. It's still unclear how much of downtown Chicago will be back at work tomorrow. Most businesses were closed today, including the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Illinois Governor Jim Edgar has said he may declare a state of emergency. I'm Ira Glass reporting from Chicago.
Negotiators for Caterpillar Incorporated and the United Auto Workers Union met today with a federal mediator in an effort to end a five-month-old strike. There was no immediate word on how today's talks progressed or whether further sessions had been scheduled. About 13,000 Caterpillar workers in Illinois were out on strike when the last round of talks broke off. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rock music today is hardly synonymous with rebellion. It's the music of high fashion haircuts and big money contracts. But there are bands that resist the packaging and even the money. One of those bands is Fugazi, a post-punk band from Washington, D.C. They've made anti-commercialism into an ethic. They won't charge more than $5 for concerts. They often play benefits for political causes. They sell their records at discounted prices, and they've turned down several offers from major record companies. They record on their own label, Discord. But when they're called a great band, as they often are, it's not just because they're idealistic. It's because they play impassioned music. Their concerts are often sold out long in advance, and they've sold 500,000 records since 1988. See what you think. This is from their latest album, Steady Diet of Nothing. Two of the members of Fugazi are my guests, Ian MacKay and Guy Picciotto. Both sing and play guitar, and both say their lives were changed by a punk concert they went to in the late 70s.
Guy and I, we both went to our first punk show in 1979. We didn't even know each other, but that show had a really powerful effect on both of us, and it took us into a whole like underground community that has really totally changed my life, so...
You were at the same concert?
Yeah, I was. There was a radio station in Washington called WGTB, which was an independent college station, but it was in a Jesuit university, and they ran an ad for an abortion clinic, and the priest sold all their equipment for a dollar to another university, literally a dollar. And it was the only station that played anything mildly alternative, is where I first heard groups like the Adverts and stuff like that. And there's a benefit concert to try to save the station, and bands like the Cramps and a bunch of local bands played. And that was the first concert I went to. I was, I guess, 13 or something. And Ian and a lot of the kids from across town were there, and a lot of people who ended up being in bands in Washington were at that show. It was just it was so frightening a night that a lot of the time I couldn't even look at the stage because the band was so intense, and like people were breaking windows and throwing chairs around, and I was just like, this has got to be the greatest thing I've ever seen, so...
What was so great about breaking windows and throwing chairs and stuff?
Well, just like being 13 and like never having any experience of music outside of giant arenas and rock bands like Aerosmith and Kiss, and suddenly seeing bands like, you know, 5 feet away from you playing incredibly intensely, obviously for no money, and like people just reacting in such a visceral way, and there was such energy in the room. And, you know, a lot of it was negative, a lot of it was positive, a lot of it was just all kinds of stuff was going on, and just to be exposed to that kind of level of interaction was just, it just kind of blew my mind wide open. And there were so many young people there, and just thinking like, you know, God, these people are in bands and stuff. I can't believe this is going on.
Listening to you talking about music, a lot of our listeners may think, well, these guys are just kind of pro-anarchy, pro-chaos, you know. But in fact, you're from a more political strain of punk music. You spend a lot of time playing benefits. And I think in Washington you haven't played a paying gig in around 2 years because just about everything you do there is benefits. Last weekend you were at the big pro-choice rally in Washington, D.C. Now, how did you fit into that? Where did you play? Where within the rally?
Well, actually, we set up the shows on the same weekend as the rally.
But for a group called Rock for Choice, which is the feminist Fund for the Feminist Majority has this wing thing called Rock for Choice where they're doing benefit concerts to help pro-choice issues or whatever. So we did two concerts in support of that fund.
Is one of the songs that you played at that benefit reclamation?
It is.
Why don't we hear that?
Okay, sure.
Do you want to say anything about writing it?
Yeah, Reclamation is a song that we first did a benefit in Ann Arbor for an abortion clinic there. And it's a song about reclaiming bodies and taking them back from people who have mistakenly thought that they were your bodies were theirs.
If you're just joining us, my guests are two of the members of the band Fugazi, Ian Mackay and Guy Picciotto. The band's politics not only apply to the kinds of benefits that you play and the kinds of concerts that you play, but you also have your own set of rules of how much you'll charge for a concert to try to make things, I guess, more accessible to your listeners?
Well, things like that. Rules might be a little heavy-handed. I'd say that it's more something along the lines of what we as people and as a band feel comfortable doing. You know, we go see a lot of shows, and obviously we'd rather pay $5 than $8 or $10 or $15 or $20 to see a band.
Do the clubs let you decide what you're going to charge for admission?
Well, that's an interesting point, because a lot of people feel like that that we demand this. But what they don't realize is that a lot of times we've had to say no so much. Like, I mean, the clubs don't really have a say, because if the club says, well, we're not going to charge $5, and we'll say, well, we're not going to play. And we've turned down so many shows, it is unbelievable, you know, because we're not going to be compromised in what we want to do. And if the situation is that the club can't reach it, then I'll discuss it. We're flexible, and we don't work on guarantees. We're not asking for anything unreasonable. What we're asking for is... we're going to come down, like, on our business end. We would expect the club to come down as well, because we're trying to, like, create an evening that's much more comfortable. When people pay $10 or $15 or $20 to see a concert, you better be good. You better be downright entertaining. We're not comfortable feeling we have to churn out entertainment every night. We want to be able to suck, and we want to make people feel like that, well, okay, they stunk, but it was cheaper in a movie, you know? And it's been really pleasurable to continue, like, trying to work this low door price thing in these bigger venues, because you have to get much more creative, and it's a lot more fun to give them a hard time because people want you to play.
So what are some of the other principles that the band operates by that you have to, that concern either pricing or admissions policies at concerts or things like that?
Well, generally speaking, we've always had the low door price, and of course, always all ages shows. They have to be open to all people.
So usually it has to be drinking age only, right?
It depends on the city, but that it tends to be 21 and up, 18 and up, you know, somewhere around there. But everyone has to be able to come in. We don't play shows that discriminate against people.
This is because you started going to concerts when you were young and you want young people to be able to get into yours?
Yeah, we'd sit outside clubs cursing, you know, bands from England that came over and played clubs that you couldn't get into, and wondering why if you were 14, somehow your musical taste was somehow considered like rotten and you weren't allowed into a place to enjoy a band. So we just said, we vowed in blood that we would never do the same thing to other kids.
Are clubs legally allowed if they serve alcohol to let in people who are
some
underage?
Aren't, and those are the ones that we don't play.
So you don't play those?
I mean, it's fine, you know. I mean, it's not a problem. They're certainly welcome to continue. It's not like we're trying to shut them down. We have to be creative in finding other venues that we can work with. I think there are a lot of clubs that could if they wanted to, but it does not behoove their business to have people who are not old enough to buy alcohol in there. So if they're gonna, you know, that's just the fact of the business. But, you know, quite honestly, rock and roll has an insidious link to the alcohol industry anyway. And I just don't care about the alcohol industry. I think it stinks. So
let me ask you, I want to get back to that concert that you described when you were 13, this like really great pivotal concert.
Yeah.
And,
and you know, and the windows
covered
were
with afterbirth afterwards.
Yeah. And windows were being broken and chairs thrown and there were tables collapsing under the weight of people. If that happened now at a concert that you were doing, would that be like terrific energy or would that be a problem?
No, that would be a problem. I mean,
yeah. Well, how come it's a problem now where it was terrific energy then?
I think it's contextual. You have to put it into a sort of a point in time. And the late 70s was a very, at that point, obviously, you know, disco music was like, had been sort of the top 40. The top 40 thing had become very removed from any kind of interaction with people. And I think music was made to be heard and not to be, there was nothing going on. And the mood in the country was totally different then. You know, and I think that it has a point. You have to put it into a context somehow, and I can't explain it other than that.
Well, there was a real sense of with that show. It was the concert was taking place within the grounds of the university, and there was an incredible sense of anger against this Georgetown University for what they had done to the station, what they were doing in terms of the right to have information about abortions and stuff like that. So there was a total sense of desperation that people were losing their only cultural outlet, and so there was. Though people were, you know, totally messing around, there was also a sense of protest about it. Where now I think a lot of the violence it shows has become really ritualized in the sense that people figure, you know, at a punk rock show they have to, like, push each other around. And there's a real sense of kind of, like, going through the motions. And there's no sense of, like, what's really unfortunate is I don't feel there's a lot of, like, really focused or directed anger right now. Like, people I think are kind of, like, bored and they'll react against the environment. But I don't think that there's a sense of, like, to where it's going or to what end. And a lot of times I feel like it's been kind of ritualized. And that's what I think we react against is the ritual. I have nothing against the energy or that sense of aggression or anger, which I think, you know, young people are more than entitled to feel. But when I see it kind of getting processed in this kind of weird way by things like MTV and stuff, which represents like certain kinds of behavior at a show in a certain light and kids just kind of go through that, then that's what I think we react against. But to me, that night, there was just a sense of possibility in the air. And there's a lot of irresponsibility, which when you get to be 26 or whatever, you can understand a little bit better. And maybe we can bring that to the show.
I was reading a review of one of your concerts in the Chicago Tribune. This is at the Vic Theater in August of 91. And the review said that you had to stop playing several times to cool off confrontations between zealous stage divers and security guards. Do you remember what happened that night?
Well, I mean, it happens all the time.
What's that kind of situation?
Generally speaking, what they're probably referring to is that we don't play music when people are fighting. We're not interested in soundtracking, that kind of stuff. And so we probably stopped to sort of defuse something that's in the crowd. We played like, 400 or 500 shows now. And I think in our like existence, I mean, of all these shows, we've probably had maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen like kind of altercations where they actually got into fighting, because we've always been really tried to pay a lot of attention to the crowds that we're playing to, and to be aware of the fact that, you know, when you have a lot of people in a room, sometimes things get a little screwy. Sometimes the bouncers are the ones, you know, the security people are the ones who are a little out of line, and they have to be talked to too. I think the point of that really, and the point of like that happens, like I said, almost every show, is only that we are part of the show and we are sharing the room with everybody else, and we feel it's our, like, we feel a responsibility to speak out if something needs to be spoken out about. That's all.
Two of the members of Fugazi are my guests, Ian MacKay and Guy Picciotto. Both sing and play guitar. Fugazi's latest album is called Steady Diet of Nothing. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are two members of the band Fugazi, Ian MacKay and Guy Picciotto, both guitarists and singers. Your singing is very high energy. It's very loud. It's almost like a shout sometimes. And yeah. I'm wondering what kind of, especially in concert probably, I'm wondering what kind of stress that puts on your voices, and what you have to do to recover after a concert.
Well, we both get hoarse voices. I tend to blow my voice out early, and then I remember my body adjusts itself to singing. Oh, this is on a tour context.
Yeah, and you're on a tour now.
Yeah,
so.
We generally when we tour, we play usually six nights a week. So yeah, I usually will sort of blow my voice out to begin with, and then my body will adjust, and I'll be all right for the rest of the tour usually. Although there's like, we both will suffer together, like blowing our voices out. But,
it's definitely, yeah. It's the agony of the flesh. I'll tell you, like every night you go home and you just feel like, why do I have a body? This is a big nightmare.
Yeah, it's a real
honestly,
problem.
It's like beyond the voice, it's like your knees hurt, your back hurts.
Well, you dance around a lot on stage.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like even when you haven't played for a while, it's like you get calluses from playing that it takes a while for them to come back, and you just,
you're both holding up your fingers.
Well, I'll just show you. Yeah, these are the guitar marks.
Oh, you're skinned on your finger, actually.
The strings are made of steel, and the whole thing is incredibly foolish. But
the thing is, it's like this thing. It's like a moment. It's like a full release, and I mean, for me, performing is as close to I've ever to. As close to being free as I've ever felt in my life. It is by far the most extreme, like, kind of feeling I've ever had, and incredibly satisfying and addictive, and you can't stop doing it. I mean, I'm 30 now, so it's like I've been playing for 12 years.
You know what I find interesting? You know, a lot of people think of punk as kind of having ended quite a few years ago, and you're still playing music that comes
we're
out
like
of
Shakers.
That.
I mean, that's what we're like. It's like, yeah, it's kind of like just doing the forgotten dance.
Is that how you feel about it?
Well, you see, the thing is,
I'll tell you, actually, I do. So the environment, the musical environment that I think we're in the 90s, I do kind of feel like a Shaker, because like things have changed a lot. I mean, money has come around, major labels have come around, a lot of the independent networks have been broken up, it's kind of hard. I mean, that kind of very what I think is very false expansion of, like, in terms of, like, you know, you have to have really huge broad appeal, and this has to, like, you know, that kind of mass perspective, I think, is really false, and I think it kind of messes up a lot of what goes on, because what we've done has always been very contextual in terms of, like, relating to a community or relating to something small. We've never felt like that we have to be massively distributed or massively accepted to be, like, important or have something to say, and I think that so I think in that way, I kind of sometimes do feel like we're kind of the last dinosaurs or something like that.
Have you turned down offers from labels, from large labels?
Many.
Why turn it down?
But we have our own label.
Discord.
And, Yeah.
They had nothing to offer us at all, because basically what their motivations are is money and marketing, and our motivations are control. You know, we have to have control, and that's why we book ourselves. That's why we have our own label, and it functions pretty well.
I guess a problem of doing it that way, or what would be a problem for some people, is that you have to take on all this responsibility beyond the music. You know, you have to take on all the business responsibilities
of
distribution of the CD and booking yourself into gigs. And I mean,
it's not for everybody.
Well, it's a lot of work,
it's
work a lot of people would gladly not have to do, so that they could focus more of their time on the music and not on the business.
Well, that's why I actually, so that it doesn't come off like we're being judgmental, I have no problem with other bands signing and doing and what they need to do to get their music out, because I think we're in a privileged position where we've got a label that has achieved like some notoriety or whatever, and we've worked hard to set up kind of like, be outside of ourselves, a network which we can work through. I don't think a lot of bands have that. I think a lot of bands need like someone to help them, you know, get their thing out or do what they want to do. And I think, you know, a lot of bands are doing great, great things, really making powerful, powerful music on major labels. I'm just saying that for us as a band, like what's really most important to us is that what we do is like within our own sphere or whatever. And I think we do suffer for it. I mean, I think since we do have to book ourselves and we do have to do all this kind of extraneous stuff, sometimes it gets in the way of our being able to be like fully creative or our being able to spend a whole lot of time doing certain things. But it's a trade-off that ultimately I think is worth it, because like at no point in the game have I ever felt like I have to point the finger at someone else. I mean, if there's blame to go around, we'll take the blame. And if there's praise to go around, we'll take the praise. But at the end of the day, it's ours, you know.
Well, Ian, you handle a lot of the business end, right?
True.
Yeah. So how do you feel about spending your time on the business end of the music?
Well, for me, the only problem I have is the time conflict.
That's a big problem.
Well, it is a problem. Yeah. But it's you know, you pay now or pay later. You know, if you don't do the work now, it's going to sneak up on you. Because then you become, one day, I feel like if I was in a band that just said, well, somebody do all my business for me, then somebody's going to go out there and make a lot of mistakes, and one day I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be a fake, hollow band that means nothing to anybody and not even to myself. And that's a much greater payment, like, to me, than to do the work now.
I have one question that I'm sure you'll think is ridiculous, but one of the reasons why I don't get to rock clubs very much is that, especially on weekday nights, the concerts are so late usually.
Yeah.
I mean, in New York, for instance, some of the concerts started around 11 or midnight.
Well, when we were young, shows in New York, the bands would go on like 5:30 a.m. Like, we would leave around 8 in the morning. I mean, those shows were seriously late-time shows.
Yeah.
Well, I have never, I mean, who can stay up that late? But, I mean, obviously you can't be a working person.
Or you go to work.
You have to drink a lot of coffee. Yeah, right. You have to be willing to really write off the next day.
I think it's sort of part of the straight, like the whole like straight time versus like time. Whatever,
right.
You know?
I've been on straight time for a long time.
Which is, me too.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what time you get.
A lot for cool time. Thanks.
So, I mean, like, here, this is like the great. Like, I get up usually around 8.
I get up around 1.
Yeah. So like But I mean, generally speaking, I like playing earlier shows personally. I mean, but it doesn't make any difference to me, you know. Because when you're on tour, like, basically when I'm on tour, I can sleep as late as I want. But when I'm home, this is a good example of where the business and the band side does come into conflict. Like, you know, it's a good point, because I do, like, if I was playing and also working, I had to get up, I would get up early and work. I'm schizophrenic, I guess. I'm a mess. What can I do?
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us. Good luck on the tour.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Ian MacKay and Guy Picciotto are members of the band Fugazi. They're playing tonight in New Haven, Connecticut, and tomorrow in Trenton, New Jersey. Fugazi's latest album is called Steady Diet of Nothing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fifty Iranian intellectuals and artists living in exile have issued a declaration in defense of Salman Rushdie. It's the first time that natives of a Muslim country have issued a collective protest against Rushdie's death sentence. Coming up, we talk with two of the exiles who signed the declaration. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Jazz, the new novel by Toni Morrison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has signed an executive order requiring federal contractors to tell non-union workers their union dues may not be used for political purposes they do not support. He signed the order in connection with a 1988 Supreme Court ruling restricting union use of non-union fees. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The executive order applies to workers who, although they are not union members, are still covered by the terms of a union contract and pay dues. Such workers may request and receive a refund of their dues used for purposes other than collective bargaining, such as political activities.
Full implementation of this principle will guarantee that no American will have his job or livelihood threatened for refusing to contribute to political activities against his will.
The executive order applies only to non-union workers employed by federal contractors. The White House denies the president's action undermines labor's traditional support for the Democratic Party. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The AFL-CIO has now moved a step closer to endorsing Bill Clinton. 20 of the group's vice presidents recommended that their governing board back Clinton at its May meeting. The move to support Clinton came from the union's Political Works Committee, chaired by President Lane Kirkland. The Labor Federation had appeared ready to stay on the sidelines for several more months. Heavy fighting is said to be continuing in several parts of Bosnia in violation of a new ceasefire agreement signed yesterday between the warring factions in the former Yugoslav Republic. Pierre Vickery reports that thousands of people have fled in recent days.
The Belgrade-based news agency Tanjug reported heavy fighting in western Herzegovina, saying hundreds of people had been killed during attacks on Croatian towns and villages by the Yugoslav army. Croatian state television claimed two federal warplanes had been shot down during a number of bombing raids. Street clashes were also reported in the capital Sarajevo as the fledgling Bosnian army tried to dismantle barricades set up by Serbian militias. Official sources say at least 500 people have died so far in the fighting and 200,000 refugees have been forced to flee their homes. A special United Nations envoy, Cyrus Vance, is expected to arrive in Bosnia tomorrow to try and negotiate a durable ceasefire. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Germany has become the first Western nation to set up diplomatic ties with the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. The German government says advisors will be sent to the former Soviet state to help it seek membership in the European community. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 14 points to close at 3,269.90. This is NPR News. In its ongoing battle with Parliament, the Russian cabinet has threatened to resign, arguing that to give up moves toward a free market could increase inflation. At the same time, President Yeltsin's cabinet said that if economic changes are not made, then Russia might be blocked from entering the world's marketplace. If the cabinet does resign, it could be the most serious government crisis since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Organization of American States is debating whether or not to adopt a resolution condemning the suspension of constitutional rule in Peru. The resolution also calls for a high-level OAS diplomatic mission in efforts to convince President Fujimori to restore democracy in Peru. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Foreign ministers at the Organization of American States said the body must stand firmly against the suspension of constitutional rule in Peru or face the reversal of democracy elsewhere. Augusto Blacker Miller, Peru's foreign minister, defended the actions of President Fujimori to suspend Congress and the judiciary. He said those actions were taken to prevent Peru from disintegrating into civil war. But Secretary of State James Baker dismissed the claims. "You do not destroy democracy in order to save it," Baker told the OAS. Other OAS foreign ministers argued that the longer constitutional rule is suspended in Peru, the more it will threaten democracy in other Latin American countries. Despite condemnation of Peru, diplomats here said OAS economic sanctions are unlikely. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In Las Vegas, Nevada, a man walked on stage where former President Ronald Reagan was giving a speech earlier today, grabbed a crystal award that Reagan had just been given, and smashed it. Pieces of the crystal statue hit Reagan, but he appeared not to be injured, and Secret Service agents rushed the man away. The former president then returned to the stage and gave his speech to the National Association of Broadcasters. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's been 3 years since the Ayatollah Khomeini issued his death sentence against the writer Salman Rushdie, and as yet no firm and decisive action has been taken by Iranians to condemn this inhuman decree. So begins a new declaration of exiled Iranian intellectuals and artists in defense of Salman Rushdie. The declaration continues, "As this attack on the freedom of expression originated in Iran, we believe that Iranian intellectuals have a special responsibility to forcefully condemn this decree and to defend Salman Rushdie." This declaration has been signed by 50 Iranians living in exile in Europe and the U.S. It's been released around the world, including in Iran. My guest Homa Sarshar is the liaison in the U.S. for this declaration. She's a journalist who hosts a Farsi radio program in Los Angeles about Iranian culture. She is Jewish and left Iran 13 years ago. Also with me is Parviz Sayoud, a Muslim who is one of Iran's best-known filmmakers. His film Dead End was banned in Iran under Khomeini. He's lived in exile since the revolution. I asked Sarshar why it's taken 3 years for Iranian exiles to organize this written protest.
This declaration has been written and sent out in the time that was needed. Maybe 3 years ago when this fatwa was out, we were not so, maybe I can say, so close to each other. We didn't felt it at that time. But any of us, any of these 50 people who signed it, they did whatever they wanted. They raised their voice, they wrote, they talk, they gave speech, they made programs in radio or television or whatever, and they talk personally, and they condemned this fatwa.
Was there a lot of debate over what the wording of this declaration should be?
No, not a lot. Maybe few words have been changed, but not a lot, no.
Do you think that the people who signed this declaration are at risk?
They might be. But we are adult. We can think, and we are ready to take whatever it take.
Was it difficult to get Iranians in exile to sign the declaration?
No and yes. No, because we didn't have any of the people that we contacted to say that I don't agree with the declaration. Everybody, every single one that we talked to and we went to and we asked, our friends, our colleagues, the journalists, artists, intellectuals, everybody said that they believe in this declaration. And if few of them didn't sign it because they were afraid, because their family was in Iran or they had some personal reason, but nobody denied that, and everybody was very proud of that, and they said that they believe in it. And another problem that we had, our time was short. And after the declaration was out, a lot of other friends and writers, intellectuals, journalists, artists, poets called or get in touch with whoever and told them that they are ready to sign and to add their signatures. So we are getting more signatures every day.
Parviz Sayoud, was it a difficult decision for you to sign the declaration?
No, it was not difficult for me. I signed this declaration because aside of its humanity motive, Mr. Rushdie's case helps us to explain our people's situation under the Islamic Republic. It helps us to show the world community the kind of pressure and hardship Iranian writers, journalists, and artists face and the kind of government they deal with.
Do you have family in Iran?
I have some part of, of course, some members of my family is still living in Iran.
Are you worried for them because of your signature on the declaration?
I was worried about them before because the nature of my activities here as a playwright is not far away the situation of the Mr. Rushdie's case.
Parviz, Salman Rushdie has written, Islam doesn't have to mean blind faith. Don't let the zealots make Muslim a terrifying word. Do you agree with those sentiments?
Exactly. Let me tell you this, that we Iranians have a long history of dictatorship and brutality under the supervision of fanatic mullahs, while at the same time, there is a long tradition of blasphemy in our literature. Look at Omar Khayyam, Hafiz, Maulana Jalaluddin, Obaid Zakani, and Iraj Mirza. By the mullah's standards of today, which Salman Rushdie rightly called them zealots, these eminent poets could be considered infidels. In fact, their works are and can be interpreted as a fusion of blasphemy and poetic thought. I believe that if these poets were alive today, they could have easily been executed by the Iran's present regime.
Do you feel that the zealots have given your religion a bad name, that people no longer really understand what Islam is?
Well, of course. You know, the poets that I just mentioned their name, they were living in a situation that by our standard of today could be much worse of what is going on today in Iran. But unfortunately, the way that it turned out today, we think that it's not possible to be a person or a poet or a writer like we had before in our history of literature and live in this same situation in Iran.
Let me add something to what Parviz said. There are a lot of mullahs in Iran right now that they want to contradict whatever the Ayatollah or other prominent figure in Islamic Republic of Iran has said, and they want to say that these are very, very harsh, and Islam is not so harsh, and they wanted to make it more mellow. But the thing is, everybody knows, when Ayatollah or a prominent figure declare a fatwa or say something about a person or order the execution of this person, none other mullahs can deny that.
Have either of you gotten into debates with friends about whether the fatwa is justified? I wonder if either of you have friends who would support it.
I don't have any friends to support this fatwa, as far as I know. But some of them might think that the case is not their with the issues that we are facing today in Iran and outside in Iran, they might think that it is not their issue or the most important issue that they have to deal with today. But all of them, as far as I know, and I believe that they don't believe in the fatwa and they don't support them.
And I think that whoever supports this death sentence for somebody who talks or who says something is not my friend.
My guests are Homa Sarshar and Parviz Sayoud, two Iranian exiles living in Los Angeles who have signed a declaration in support of Salman Rushdie. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about a declaration in support of Salman Rushdie issued by Iranians living in exile in America and Europe. My guest, Homa Sarshar, is the liaison in the U.S. for the declaration. Parviz Sayoud is one of the exiles who signed. Can I ask you each to tell the story of why you left when you did, when you knew it was time for you to get out of Iran?
The reason that I left the country was because I was working with Kayhan, which is a very prominent newspaper in Iran, for 15 years at that time. And the day that I finally decided to leave the country was before Khomeini comes to Iran. And that was one day that I was working in my office. And one of my colleagues told me that as a Jewish woman, I was not allowed to translate news that was coming from France, because I was the French translator also in the newspaper, about Khomeini, because that would make news from Khomeini dirty. And he was an intellectual. He was a journalist himself. And at that day, when I came home, I told my husband that I'm flaring something, and that I am feeling something is coming. And if an intellectual will say that to me, he was my friend, he was my colleague for 15 years, and he never reacted as such. So I said, when somebody like him does that, we should be waiting for more than that from other people, from the mass, or from the people who are religious people or clergy coming up to our country.
Parviz, what was your story about leaving?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I had a small theater in Iran. I was running a theater. That was the only non-governmental theater in Iran. It belonged to a private sector. When the revolution took place, I was out of Iran. I was in Germany and planning a co-production with a German company for making a feature film. And as the revolution took place, they first I heard that they took over my theater. That one Islamic group. And then after that, they bombed my film, Dead End, that it was screened for the first time, and they bombed the film as well. And I thought to myself that this is not a place for me to go back. And I stayed, and I came to the United States, and I'm here since then.
Has it been difficult for you to find work in America, or has that been going okay?
That's a good question.
What do you think?
Me, Parviz, and most of our friends were people who have been used to live by writing Persian, by speaking Persian, and by expressing their feelings in Farsi, in Persian, in our own mother language. And finding a job outside Iran, for us, for me personally, was very difficult, because my only specialty is writing in my mother language.
Yes. Homa put it in the best way that it's possible to mention. I managed to survive somehow by communicating with my fellow men and women who live here in the United States and Europe by writing plays and staging them on and taking the play on tour, and somehow I survived. But I know many of my colleagues who live in Europe, in different part of Europe, and here in America and Canada, and they're really hopeless. They can't function because they just as Homa put it, they're starving for work, and they can't find a possibility for that. And then, as I see them hopeless, it's a bad feeling that I can't mention it to you.
So by fighting for Salman Rushdie's right of speech, you're in a way fighting for the freedom of your country, maybe in the hopes that someday you can return to it?
Oh. Well, exactly. This is the only hope that we have. And we, you see, this is. I would like to say that I believe the government. Earlier, you mentioned about the United States policy towards Salman Rushdie. I believe that all governments and the international organizations and whoever is concerned with human rights should take the danger of religious fascism more seriously. Salman Rushdie's case proves that this is not only a local incident, and continuous violation of human rights in Iran is not only a domestic concern. Religious fascism is a serious danger for the world community, like air pollution, like environmental destruction. Iran's present regime cannot become better, moderate, or modified by diplomatic talk or negotiation or other civilized method. The system of Velayat Faqih has to be stopped, isolated, until they are dismissed by the people of Iran. Period.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. We appreciate you calling us.
Thank you.
Homa Sarshar and Parviz Sayoud, the Declaration of Exiled Iranian Intellectuals and Artists in Defense of Salman Rushdie, will be published in the next edition of the New York Review of Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what stories they're following at All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up?
Well, today, Terry, we have a report on President Bush taking aim at the way that organized labor uses money in politics, particularly the money of people who aren't actually members of the unions. We'll also be hearing about the resignation of Russian President Boris Yeltsin's cabinet, about child labor in India, a special report by Daniel Zwerdling about young children who work in a match company in India. And we'll be hearing about a new product that Pepsi-Cola is test marketing starting today. It is called Crystal Pepsi. It's a cola, but it's crystal clear.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Toni Morrison has a new novel called Jazz. Her earlier books include The Bluest Eye, Sula, Song of Solomon, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award, and Beloved, which won a Pulitzer. Book critic John Leonard has this review of Jazz.
In Harlem, in 1926, a 50-year-old man falls in love with an 18-year-old girl who goes dancing without him, and so he shoots her. And then his wife goes to the funeral and tries with a knife to disfigure the dead girl's face. To find out why this happened, all of it on the first page of Toni Morrison's new magic act, you'll have to listen to the end of Jazz, as if Sidney Bechet had met the Archduke Trio, as if Ellington had gone Baroque. You'll get the city, designed for dreamy danger, for desire instead of love, for glow and thriftlessness, and smelling good and looking raunchy. You'll get the music of colored men who float down from the sky blowing saxophones, the drums of the dead on Fifth Avenue, and the clarinets of men in shirt sleeves on the rooftops, and the flourish and roar of fingered horns in the juke joint, barrel hooch, and tonk house, the six-string guitars of the blues man, and brass so pure and steady and cut so fine, you would have thought that everything had been forgiven. You will hear about newspapers like The Crisis and The Messenger, unions like the Pullman Porters, political parties like the Readjusters, and race riots like East St. Louis, about polishing shoes, rolling tobacco, ironing hair, cleaning fish, cleaning toilets, and selling, door-to-door from a sample case, number 2 nut brown, Frida's Egyptian hair pomade, and, of course, vanishing cream. You'll have to reverse the northward migration to this risky city, go south again to the Virginia sugarcane and the hibiscus, the mules and possums and walnut trees, a butter press, a broken plow, a rainbow and a fox, a blade of blackbirds and a portent of red wings, a tree on the river called Treason, whose roots grow backwards against logic, climbing toward leaves and wind and light, a cave where one mother is a witch, a well where another mother drowns. Jazz is a novel of dispossession and of haunting. Book by book, Morrison reimagines the lost history of her people, their love and work and nightmare passage and redemptive music, a ghostly chorale. It's a brilliant project, a whole galaxy with humming spheres and its own gravity, and this brand new star, which is even trickier than usual. If jazz is a music the performer composes himself, then this novel she calls jazz is a book that composes itself. Who tells us this story of deep-down spooky love? Maybe a clarinet. Maybe even Thunder, the female god from the Gnostic Gospels, Morrison quotes in her epigraph. But listen closely to the narrator, describing herself as muscleless, living too much in her own mind, too often abandoned by her partner just when she's begun to speak, uneasy and careless and missing the mark, longing to be, and I quote, the language that wishes him well, speaks his name, wakes him up when his eyes need to be open. Our narrator, having dazzled us, concludes with these words. If I were able, I'd say it. Say, make me, remake me. You are free to do it, and I am free to let you, because look, look, look where your hands are, now. Where our hands are now, of course, is holding her book. The book is talking to us. How's that for modernism? In my opinion, Toni Morrison is the best writer in America. Jazz for sure, but also Mozart.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Toni Morrison's new novel, Jazz. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the deepening divide between the governed and the governing. We talk with journalist William Grider. He's written a new book about the breakdown of democracy in the United States. It's also the subject of Grider's Frontline documentary on PBS this week. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
About 58.